Hello, I'm Richard Adey. Welcome to Sunday Profile. Today, Mr. Mining, the Chief Executive of the Minerals Council, Mitch Hook. Mining is big. It's the country's biggest export earner, the biggest business investor, and the biggest contributor to Western Australia's economic boom. It produces big personal fortunes, Gina Rinehart, Andrew Forrest, Nathan Tinkler and Clive Palmer, and nourishes some pretty big egos too. BHP Billiton and Rio Tinto are global mining giants, and all this size means the industry has a lot of clout. As you'll remember, when the Rudd government tried to bring in a tax on mining super profits, the miners fought back, commissioning television ads and carpeting the airwaves with them. Mitch Hook was at the heart of it all. He signed off on every ad and injected himself into public debate. His forceful advocacy was everywhere. And he won. Julia Gillard became Prime Minister, and one of her first actions was to take the super profits tax off the table and propose the more amenable minerals resource rent tax. The legislation to bring it in is now in the Senate. Mitch Hook has been in Canberra for more than 20 years. He's seen a lot. So what has he made of Kevin Rudd's recent campaign to win back the top job?
Oh, I was a little bemused, but I've always been bemused by the political processes. Sometimes I think that it's a bit like a whole pack of dogs chasing a tire, you know, on the back of a ute or something, and they're all scrambling over each other to get there, and when they do catch the tire, they're not really sure what they're going to do with it. And that's essentially what's characterised the upheaval over the last few weeks, and we have a real concern that the policy agenda in this town is actually taking us back to an era past. And so instead of concentrating on redressing the economic reform inertia, they tended to be like the pack of dogs, all jumping all over each other and not really knowing where they were going.
I mean, it's fair to say that you, and I guess many of your colleagues in the industry, have a pretty poor impression of Kevin Rudd now.
Well, he got elected on a substantial platform. His 2007 narrative was right in the slot. He wanted to build national capacity. He talked a lot about fixing up deficiencies in education and training, both the vocational aspects and also tertiary education. He talked about being fiscally conservative. Now, that was jargon for essentially making sure that you don't spend more than you've got. He talked a lot about redressing capacity constraints, both physical infrastructure, the export corridors, as well as the social infrastructure in outlying areas of Australia, rural and remote regions of Australia. So, you know, when you put it all together, and even the stoush we had in the lead-up to that election on workplace relations, there were still a lot of elements that were retained in the package that he took to the election that would have enabled us to maintain the critical direct relationships that we'd built up between the employer and the employee, built up over the years of essentially the Reith reforms. So Kevin Rudd got elected on that platform, and it was a good platform. He got mugged by the global financial crisis. He essentially shifted the emphasis of policy to the redistribution of wealth, carving up the cake, rather than building the cake, and so increasing the size of the cake. And essentially, he didn't really recover from that kind of shift. He even wrote that famous economic essay that said government's no better than markets. Well, you know, I imagine former Prime Minister Bob Hawke and Treasurer Paul Keating would be turning in their political graves, because they were really the architects of opening up the economy. And then we had three decades of remarkable reforms that have positioned Australia very well.
So your assessment of him changed over that time. Your industry is kind of woven into the leadership saga that Labor have been going through, because the anti-mining tax ads in 2010 had a big impact. It became part of the political polling, was reflected in that. How involved were you in developing that campaign?
Front and centre. As the Chief Executive Officer of the Minerals Council of Australia, my name was all over those ads.
It certainly was.
And I don't tick off on something that I don't have equity interest in. So we had nowhere else to go. We had spent an awful lot of time through the process of the Henry Review, leading up to the government's announcement in working through on a platform of reform. We were the ones that put the concept of shifting the royalty system in Australia from output-based to a profits-based system. Now, again, this is getting a bit technical, but basically we said we think we can do this better. And that was taken as essentially a platform to belt us with our own baseball bat. And what essentially happened was that the doors of engagement closed. The sort of overtures of, you know, you'll be right, we'll do this, we'll consult, we'll set it all up, what have you, just kind of evaporated. And I've been a CEO for nearly 22 years in this town, and I've seldom seen a dialogue of engagement and consideration so abruptly terminated.
So they stopped taking your calls, effectively?
Oh, pretty well, yeah. That was probably middle of 2009. And I said to the board, we're going to get a belting. But we had to do the Neville Chamberlain. We had to, you know, peace in our time. We knew we were going to be going to war. So, we prepared ourselves for essentially what had been a marked shift. So I said, 22 years in this town, the first 18 years, never was I ever involved in any kind of advertising campaigns. You'd sit down with the Hawke and Keating governments and the Keating governments and the Howard and Costello governments, and you'd work things through. And I used to always say to my people, once we're out in the media promulgating an issue, we're 9/10 shot.
Did the Prime Minister at the time, Kevin Rudd, or the Treasurer, Wayne Swan, ever call you to try to talk after those ads started hitting the screen? Or did the negotiations only begin after the leadership change?
No and yes.
Right. What about, because you've made the point that what you do, traditionally it's done discreetly. It's about access, it's about an engagement with ministers, and I imagine public servants as well, and making arguments that way. And you had to do it in the open. But
Well, just hang on, Tick. I wouldn't want your listeners to think that, you know, this is somehow, you know, under the carpet and clandestine.
No, but it's a behind-closed-doors thing.
Well, there is also associated public exposure and commentary. There's all sorts of hearings, parliamentary hearings, inquiries, there's submissions, there's all that sort of stuff. And you're right, access is one issue, but we've never had an issue with access. We have never had an issue with respect and consideration in working these things through until the door got shut and then we got essentially ambushed with the May 2010 announcement that there will be a rate, and it will be a rate that will put you way over the top of the Mount Everest of tax rates by international comparisons, and essentially destroying value on a whole stack of projects.
Well, I remember there were a lot of appearances you made at the time, and you were talking about sovereign risk. That was hyperbole, though. That was for effect, surely.
Well, I wish that was true.
If you look now at Africa, South Africa's entertaining a 50% super profits tax, a 50% capital gains tax on the sale of prospecting rights. Ghana's saying, it could all be up for grabs, but tax on miners will go up to 35%, then a 10% windfall tax on super profits. Zimbabwe saying, we want 51% of your business. That's a sovereign risk, not what Australia was talking about.
During the course of the super profits tax, we commissioned the Fraser Institute in Canada. This is the independent body that essentially assesses all of those jurisdictions and a lot more for what they call the Public Policy Potential Index. Now, that's jargon for essentially how does the sovereign risk, and that is the risk associated with the government of the day, their policy framework and the prospectivity. You know, it's the potential to discover ore and to be able to develop and essentially produce minerals from those ores. And that Fraser Institute surveys some 400 CEOs across 51 jurisdictions. Now, we dropped to 31 out of 51 through that super profits tax. People were looking at us with a great deal of jaundice. The point is, it's a global industry and sovereign risk is a big part of the equation, and governments getting the policy framework wrong, that is a big factor.
Hello, it's Richard Ady here. It's Sunday Profile on ABC Radio, and we're joined today by Mitch Hook, the Chief Executive of the Minerals Council of Australia. So if I go back to 2010, when you put an end to the super profits tax, gone, billions of dollars essentially saved for the mining companies, how did that feel?
Well, relief. and the billions of dollars saved for the mining companies was actually an opportunity cost. That did presume business as usual, and I can tell you it would not have been business as usual. So when we got to the point we got to where that was shelved, and the new Prime Minister Gillard said, we want to work with the industry, we were relieved, and we were hoping that there would be a proper structure put in place. There was.
Mm.
It was called the Argus. Don Argus, former BHP Billiton chairman, and Minister Ferguson chaired what was known as the Policy Transition Group. Basically just a nice title for let's work with industry and the bureaucracy through the processes of how we can give effect to what was the heads of agreement reached with the Prime Minister on what the nature and framework of this new tax would look like. Let's be clear, it's not tax reform. This is a top-up tax. This is a tax on top of what we already pay. I have said many times in front of both the House and the Senate inquiries that this new tax is not necessary for Australians to be sharing in the benefits of this boom. When the boom started, royalties and company tax amounted to about $5 billion. Last year, we will be paying nearly $24 billion. That's nearly a 500% increase since the boom started. That's what's going in state royalties, state and territory royalties, and in company tax. So as we've increased our profits, as we've increased our volumes, as prices have increased, so too has the take.
Mitchell, partly as a result of your successful and sometimes forceful advocacy, it has been reported that you're not the Labor Party's favourite person, that relations are pretty awful. Is that true?
Not from where I sit. I'm sure that there are plenty of people who would like to portray it that way.
But you'd be aware if you were getting a frosty time.
I would be very aware of that. It's very civil, it's very courteous, it's very respectful. The Prime Minister attended the Minerals Week annual parliamentary dinner last year, as did the Treasurer, as did a whole stack of ministers. I think there were about 100 and something odd members of Parliament at that dinner. We have a very close working relationship across a whole stack of portfolios, not just Minister Ferguson, but the whole lot.
You've mentioned a couple of times the Resources Minister, Martin Ferguson. What's your relationship been like with him?
Oh, it's good. Yeah, very good. He's an incredible talent. He understands the industry. He's got a great strategic mind. He's no sycophant, I'll tell you that. He's got such a clinical mind and a capacity for rigorous analysis and an understanding of the logic of an argument. But he's also an extremely capable political operator, and I mean that in the nice sense. In other words, he knows and understands the environment in which he's operating in, and he understands the challenges facing the industry, the twin challenges of significantly increasing cost structure here in Australia, declining productivity. And I guess the critical thing is he's got the confidence of the industry.
You've mentioned bipartisanship, and obviously in your position you have to be able to work with whoever's in power. But with your positions on industrial relations reform and tax and regulation over 20-odd years, you're surely an instinctive coalition supporter, personally.
Nobody's ever been able to pick my politics, and you're probably the first one that I can ever remember asking me that question. But my instinct is for open market economies. Maybe some people out there won't know this, but my private view is I have a very strong sense of social justice. I don't have a problem paying taxes to help those who are seriously disadvantaged and seriously in a socially compromised position. I have a real soft spot in that area, but I am a real believer in the market. I don't like protected shops. I don't like closeted industries. I don't like protectionism. It doesn't work. Mm. Never has worked. I'm really keen on the reward for the individual. I love the success attitude of the Americans. I think the way they celebrate success and they strive for innovation and entrepreneurial excellence is fantastic, but I would never be a party to leaving my rubbish on the streets the way my American friends do. And I don't mean that in a pejorative sense. I just mean they don't have quite the instinct and the institutional structures that we have here in Australia to ensure that a civil society can look after those who aren't as in fortunate positions. So, and the one thing I've noticed over my 30-odd years in public policy now is how the whole dynamic has shifted from the collective. and it's shifted to the individual.
It has.
If you think about when we were growing up, we had every single arm of macroeconomic policy was under the control of government. We all had defined superannuation. We all had collective, centralised, controlled labour markets. We had protected industries. We had agricultural statutory marketing arrangements. You know, there was everything. You couldn't be sacked in the public service. Fast forward now, and the market, the economy's open. People have got their own superannuation. You've got your own individual contracts in the workplace, largely. It's all shifted. Agricultural marketing is now about the market and market responsiveness. So it's shifted more to the individual. That's a pretty uncertain place when the market's going against you. You know, if everybody wants a superannuation account when it's a bull market, when it's a bear market,
yes,
you're looking around for somebody else to offset your risk. So that's my point about there needs to be a safety net.
I'm interested as to how much of these views comes from your upbringing. You're basically from a farm in country Victoria. And I imagine that has been very formative in how you've approached your life.
Yeah. My country upbringing, my parents, and particularly my father, and if Mum's listening, I hope she doesn't take exception to this, but both of them. But Dad really instilled values and cultures in us kids. I'm one of five. And that was the thing that really he impressed upon us, about integrity, about credibility, looking in the mirror to judge yourself, not having your peers and other people around the place to be that mirror, because it's always cracked. You know, people will always tell you things and say things and what have you. And if you have to define your own sense of self-worth in how others perceive you, then that can be rather hurtful and even fraught. But I say that not with arrogance. I don't think you should be insensitive to other people's views, and I think you should be sensitive to those around you. But I think your own culture and your own values and your own standards, they're the things that really stand you in good stead. And there's no question that that was a critical part of our upbringing. Going off to boarding school I think I was about 10 from memory, and having 7 years at boarding school was also pretty formative in understanding the rigours of life. They're nothing like the boarding schools of today. Back then, it was pretty clinical. It was a fair bit of discipline and a fair bit of. It was about identifying with yourself and knowing and learning how to get on with others. Because if you didn't, you just went down a one-way track.
Yeah,
that was a very formative part. But I love the country and I love the country atmosphere and I love the country people. That's no question. That's where my great love is. And my frustration in life is that I've never actually got back to the land. I went off and did a rural science degree up at the University of New England. I always wanted to go back on the land, and as fate would have it, it set me off into a path of public policy, which I've also loved. But there's no question my love is in the origins of my life, and that's the land.
Well, I understand you did get back to the farm briefly, but then I think after your father died, but then the Minerals Council came calling.
Oh, I didn't go back there, but you're right. Yeah, after Dad died, I did toy with going back, all but briefly, and as you say, along came some pretty influential guys in the minerals industry, and I knocked them back the first two or three times because I seriously thought that I would like to go and do something different than public policy. But what really captured my attention was these very influential mining CEOs were talking to me, and they were looking down the barrel at losing their social license to operate, and they knew they had a problem, and they really wanted to know how they were going to go about transforming this industry. Now, they weren't looking for me to be the light on the hill, but they were looking for me to help work an industry organisation through the processes of what needed to be a substantial transformational change in this industry, and one of where it was perceived as having very poor regard for the environment and its social stewardship responsibilities. Fast forward 10 years and its commitment to the practical implementation of sustainable development is unquestionably an epiphany for the industry.
And well, 10 years in and 20-odd years in different roles in Canberra, what do you want to do next?
Oh, retire.
But you're only, what, 55, something like that?
That's true. I don't want to move out of where I am to go and do it again. If anything, it's probably taking me all of that time you mentioned, the 9, 10 years I've been here, to develop an instinct for this industry Public policy is pretty universal across all three sectors I've been involved in the agriculture and food and now mining and minerals. But getting an instinct for the industry is really an important part of the equation. Having been born on the land and understanding the science of it all, having been taught that through university, you know, I didn't do too badly in terms of the instinct equations in agriculture and in food. But coming into mining, this was foreign. You know, I had very little understanding and concept and appreciation, and I really struggled for some time to develop that instinct. And I probably still haven't got it, but I'm much better placed than I was when I started.
You were saying before you're bemused by politics. I'm wondering.
Bemused by the leadership challenge.
Right. Okay. Well, yeah. I suppose I'm wondering about a political career. Have you been approached?
Yeah, but not lately. All through my career, people have flattered me by suggesting that I should go into politics. You asked earlier about, you know, what political instinct. Well, it might surprise you that I've had offers from all three parties. Even the Democrats wanted to know whether I was interested in that space. You may remember.
But they're gone now. What about the Greens? Well, I bet they haven't come calling.
Well, I'd love to tell you that Bob Brown is coming out of yarn, but I couldn't. That wouldn't be. Yeah, I've known Bob quite a while, and we've had a number of discussions, but he has a different perspective on how to prosecute a case than what I do. And I also don't. I just don't identify with their agenda. I mean, sustainable development is one thing, but and that's absolutely fundamental to what we're about, and getting the balance between environment, social and economic right. But when you set out on a path of anti-development, you just end up with a whole stack of people in very poor circumstances.
I'm interested, though, as to whether you would contemplate a move into politics.
And the reason I rule it out is I've had my fill, but not to the point where I've had a gutful, but I've certainly had the experience of public policy, and I've loved that. But I'm not in the business of politics, where you have to go through the kind of stuff we've seen over the last few weeks, months, whatever. I love being part of teams, and, you know, I think it was, I can't remember who it was now, but somebody said, if you want a friend in Parliament, go buy a dog. Go get a dog. And I couldn't play in that kind of space where it was more about what the individual was doing rather than the team. Now, there'll be a lot of politicians listening to this who'll think that's a backhander. It's not. It's just the nature of how they do it. And it's highly competitive and highly contestable environment. I take my hat off to those people. I can tell your listeners that having been involved in this town and watched them, these people work themselves into nearly an early grave. And you know, I have a wife and three beautiful daughters, and I'm not prepared to squander the time that I have with them to go into politics. Now, some will say, well, you know, somebody's got to do it, and that's a bit arrogant, and that's a bit selfish. Well, maybe, and I'll wear that accusation, because my contribution has been in the public policy space. People don't go into the jobs that I do to make money. You do it because you get a buzz out of public policy. We're fairly well remunerated, don't get me wrong. I'm not complaining about being poor or suggesting that we're not well looked after. But you don't make the big bucks that you would if you went into the commercial world. And so the benefits and the rewards are the intangibles, and they are being involved in public policy and actually, as you rightly said earlier on, actually making a difference.
Well, I hope you get to scratch the itch about being on the land at some point. And thanks very much for being our guest today.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you very much for having me.
Mitch Hook is the CEO of the Minerals Council of Australia. I'm Richard Adie. Thanks for joining me today on Sunday Profile, which is produced by Belinda Sommer. For a transcript or audio of today's interview, head to the RN website, abc.net.au/radionational. Talk to you next week.